Well, good morning and welcome to Inspiration. I'm your host, Jessica Turvey, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, an information access service. Inspiration, well, it's all around you. From the moment you awaken and splash cool and refreshing water on your face, breathe in deeply that morning air and feel the rays of sunlight on your face. In today's program, well, I'm looking forward to putting a smile on your face and maybe even giving you some thoughts to share with someone else a little later this morning. If you joined me last week, you might recall that I was reading from an article called The Power of Everyday People. It first appeared in Guidepost magazine, and it was written by Bill Courtney. Now, Bill has a very well-known podcast called An Army of Normal Folks. And I read you about two of those normal folks that were profiled on his podcast. The first one was written about Arshay Cooper, and he overcame the barrier of the problem is too big, and he did it through his volunteer activities. The second one was barrier number two, and what can someone like me do? It was written about John Ponder, and he also appeared in Guidepost magazine in that article. And the third barrier, I don't know how, about Amy Crenshaw, and that's what I'd like to start with today, how she overcame this barrier, and it was profiled in the podcast called Ordinary Folks and an army of Ordinary Folks. Amy Crenshaw of Jackson, Tennessee, was used to cooking for a crowd. She and her husband Jim, a doctor, felt called by God to adopt and had a large family. Their nine kids included two adopted from Ethiopia and four from China. A decade ago, Crenshaw's oldest daughter was doing mission work in downtown Denver when she discovered the SAME, S-A-M-E, cafe. The restaurant's name is an acronym for So All May Eat. The cafe served a small menu and charged whatever you can pay. That was the quotation that was on the menu. How did such a business survive? Well, the owners found that when you treat your customers with kindness, they not only return the favor, but extend that kindness to others. Generosity and community break out all around. Amy felt inspired to start a cafe like that in Jackson, Tennessee. Her kids were growing up, and she wanted to be part of reviving her city's downtown. One problem? She'd never run a restaurant before. That would have stopped a lot of people. Amy picked up the phone, called the owners of the same cafe, and asked how they did it. Turned out she knew more about serving food than she thought. Remember her busy kitchen at home? Since 2013, the Come Unity Cafe in Jackson, Tennessee, has been serving a small pay-what-you-can menu of healthy soups, salads, and sandwiches to everyone who sits down at one of the long wooden tables. Homeless people, judges, and lawyers from the nearby courthouse, families, tourists, busy business people, you name it. This isn't my cafe, it's the community's cafe, Amy says. We just rely on people to be generous. When they walk out feeling satisfied, we know we have succeeded. By now, you know the drill. Amy's passion to help her community combined with her cooking know-how, which they then took off when her daughter told her about a new kind of restaurant. What do you care about? What do you know how to do? What opportunities are waiting in your community? You don't have to be an extraordinary person to join the army of normal folks. You just need those three basic ingredients. Well, those and one more. I'm sure you noticed that God was there when Arshay, John, and Amy decided to act on their desires to serve. He was there for me too when I decided to become a coach. Give him your passion and your discipline, and he'll be there when you come across an opportunity. Trust me, it will change your life. So that's the end of the article that I wanted to finish off with here this week. It's called The Power of Everyday People. It was in Guidepost magazine in the February-March edition, and it was written by Bill Courtney. So also in Guidepost magazine, there was another great story that I wanted to share with you. It's called The Home I Wanted. It's by Jeanette Levely from Paris, Illinois. I loved living in rural Paris, Illinois, where my pastor husband Kevin and I moved from Los Angeles more than 20 years ago. All I needed to make my life complete was my own house. I prayed the same prayer every day. Lord, I need a home, not just a house the church provides for the pastor, which I appreciate, but a piece of property that Kevin and I own. I even detailed how I wanted to live in the country with trees and critters of every kind surrounding me. But I worried that time was running out. Honey, I said one Saturday morning 4 years ago as we sat down to breakfast, the longer we wait to buy a house, the less likely that a bank will give us a loan. You know, I've saved up enough for a down payment. We don't need a house anytime soon, Kevin said. As long as I'm a pastor, we'll have a parsonage. I knew Kevin loved to preach and teach the Bible so much that at age 70, he wasn't even considering retiring. Maybe he was in denial that he might not have a choice someday. I couldn't come out and say that, so I tried another tack. Have you thought about what might happen to me if you go to heaven before I do, or we wait till we're too old to buy a house? If Kevin really cared about what happened to me, I reasoned, he'd go along with my plans for our future. What had attracted me to him more than 40 years earlier was his reliable, easygoing personality, the opposite of both my undependable alcoholic father, whom my mother divorced when I was six, and my unreasonable alcoholic stepdad, who raised me. My stepdad often said, "It's my way or the highway." Even as a child, I knew what that meant. I didn't have a vote. I didn't have any control over my circumstances. "Of course I want you to be taken care of," Kevin said. "I love you, Jeanette. I'm just not ready to commit to the responsibility of owning a home at this point." Was he ever going to be ready? I may have raised my voice a few decibels. Kevin may have tossed his plate in the sink a bit louder than usual and left the room. I may have followed him into his den to give a louder voice. A few more reasons why we should start house shopping. Our four cats scattered down the hall to hide under beds. Why couldn't Kevin and I agree on this? We agreed on almost everything else. Even early in our marriage, when the churches we pastored barely paid us enough to go from one paycheck to the next, we didn't argue over money. Instead, we focused on our relationship and raising our children, Esther and Ron. Now, as empty nesters, who'd been married 49 years, we both had great jobs. I was an office manager for a local business. We pastored a church full of generous people. They took us out to dinner every Sunday, planted a big vegetable garden for us, even let me choose the stove and wallpaper for the parsonage. But I still craved a home of my own. I waited until my birthday the next summer to make another pitch. Surely Kevin wouldn't turn me down on my birthday. "Thanks for grilling out tonight, honey," I said. "I appreciate you." I reached for his hand. "Guess what? I saw a piece of property today that's for sale in a quiet neighborhood. Do you mind if I look into it? We could buy it now with our down payment and build on it later after we've saved some more." Kevin's hand tightened around mine. "I'm still not ready to do that." I had another solution prepared. "Then we can buy a cheap fixer-upper and make it as pretty as our finances will allow." "Listen, honey," Kevin said. "One of the guys in my Saturday Bible study has done that a few times. His stories about all the plumbing and wiring issues scare me. And he's handy. We would have to hire professionals. We can't afford that." I took a deep breath and offered my final idea. "Buy a share of our daughter's house and turn her huge basement into an apartment." Kev shook his head. "I don't think it's a good idea to move in with Esther. at least not until her kids are grown and on their own. I let go of Kevin's hand and got up from the table, determined not to argue. Why ruin my birthday with a fight? I trudged across the kitchen, fighting back tears. I'd kept calm, but what good did it do? Kevin still hadn't come around. One morning, 2 months later, I watched from the dining room window as the cardinals, finches, and chickadees jostled for position at our bird feeders. The maples bordering the parsonage had begun their turn to a gorgeous shade of orange. I stood silent for several minutes as a realization took hold. Here we were living in the country, surrounded by trees. Squirrels and raccoons often visited us, even an occasional chipmunk or rabbit. This is what I prayed for all these years, I said aloud with a catch in my throat. Father God, you gave me everything I've wanted in a home. We just didn't own it. Why had I been so blind to the Lord's provision? I pondered the many times, especially during those early and very lean days, that God had taken care of us. A couple from our church gave us dining out cards several years in a row. Friends shared beautiful hand-me-down clothes for the kids, clothes we couldn't afford. Once we even won a week-long trip to a ranch in the wilds of Colorado. As each of these instances of provision came to mind, my thinking shifted a bit more. All these years, I'd equated God's and Kevin's love and care for me with getting what I wanted, owning a house so I could feel secure about the future. I thought I'd put my chaotic upbringing behind me, but in some ways, I was still that powerless little girl in an alcoholic household who had no say over what happened to her. What could I let go of? Could I let go of my need for control and just trust in the Lord? Trust Him, in the present, in the moment? It takes time to overcome such deep-rooted anxiety, but I've been working on it. A few months ago, as we walked up the tree-lined lane near our house, I reached for my husband's hand. My voice wobbled. I have something serious to say, Kevin, so just bear with me. Kevin gently pulled me to the side of the lane and stopped. It takes as long as you need, Jeanette, he said softly. His eyes met mine, those kind eyes I so loved. I'm sorry I've been pressuring you to buy a house. I'd slipped into thinking that my happiness depended on it, and I thought you were holding me back, I said. Growing up the way I did made me so anxious because over our future. I couldn't even see God has given me the home I wanted all along. He said, I'm sorry too. I should have tried harder to understand where you were coming from. Then Kevin hugged me tight. Right there on the side of the lane with the chickadees and red-winged blackbirds watching. Kevin keeps working on pastoring, and I keep working on owning a home. Only now I'm not driven by anxiety, but by trust in the Lord, who loves me even better than Kevin does, and who holds our future in his hands. That story first appeared in Guidepost magazine. It was the February-March edition, and it was written by Jeanette Levely, called The Home I Wanted. Just before I go on to my reading, let me just remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, where we offer 24 hours a day and 7 days a week of programming from over 265 publications. I'd like to dip back into the Guidepost magazine. This story now was written by Diane Stark from Brazil, Indiana. Diane calls her article, As God Sees Me. She says, in this article, the hygienist greeted my 14-year-old son, Nathan, as he settled into the dentist chair. I knew when you were a little guy, she said. Nathan grinned. I'm better behaved now, he said. She waved a hand. Hey, all kids act out at the dentist, she said, adjusting his paper bib and easing back the chair. Nathan's face grew serious. No, I really was a bad kid.
he insisted. Like when I was four, I had a huge tantrum at the grocery just because Mom wouldn't let me have a matchbox car. People stared and I kept screaming. Mom got right in my face. "You better stop it right now," she said, "or else." I sat in a chair in the corner, taken aback. The tantrum had happened years ago, and I told the story to friends and family for laughs. It was ancient history now. Why on earth did Nathan think that by telling the hygienist, this was the thing to do? I shook my head slightly to signal him, but he went on. I squared my shoulders, puffed out my chest, looked right back at Mum, and shouted, "I'm not afraid of you." Mum was stunned. Then she dragged me out to the car. I'm the youngest of five, and I guess Mum had never had her authority challenged like that. Nathan shrugged. "I told you I was a bad kid." The hygienist laughed and said, "You sure were." Then she mercifully began the cleaning. My face burned with shame. What kind of a mother was I? Did Nathan really believe he'd been a bad kid? Had he carried this long-ago incident with him all these years? It was just a funny story. He was only four. All kids throw tantrums. I never meant him to take it so seriously. In the car afterward, I said, "You weren't a bad kid, Nathan. I'm sorry if I made you feel as if you were. It was wrong of me to tell that story so many times. You're a great kid." "I forgive you, Mom," he said, patting my shoulder. "You didn't mean to make me feel bad. It's just the way you are. Heck, you criticize yourself all the time." "I'm not going to tell that story ever again. You need to see yourself the way God sees you." "Yeah," Nathan said, then paused. "But why do you put yourself down so much, Mom? God loves you too." I swallowed hard and took a deep breath. I wasn't used to my son calling me out. He was sure growing up. "Okay," I said. "You've given me something to think about. How about we get some ice cream?" When my husband Eric got home from work, I was still beating myself up for ever telling that story about Nathan's tantrum. I thought I was a good mom, but all this time I was making him feel bad about himself. I said to Eric, practically in tears, "You are a good mom, a great mom. But no one is perfect," he told me. "All parents make mistakes, lots of them, and you've got to be okay with that." "But our kids deserve the best, Mom." Eric shook his head. "No, they deserve a mom who is doing her best." Then he kissed me and went upstairs to change out of his work clothes. I need to do better. Even me at my best isn't very good. And now, here I was doing the very thing that Nathan had called me out on. Why was I so hard on myself? What kind of example was I setting? Later that evening, I went into my home office and found one of Nathan's school pictures propped up against my computer. Next to it was a little note in his handwriting. "If you wouldn't say it to him, then don't say it to yourself either." I stared at his picture, regretting all over again that I'd never made him feel so bad. But even more, I was moved by how much Nathan wanted to help me. Only 14 years old and already so wise. I wiped away a tear. I didn't understand why I was so hard on myself or why I had to let everyone know it. Nathan was right. I was always putting myself down. It wasn't as if my parents were hypercritical. Like any kid, I would hear about it when I messed up. Yet even then, I couldn't let go of the negative self-talk. There was one incident when I was 10. My sister and I had stayed overnight with our mother's best friend, a sweet woman we called Aunt Nancy, who was a little on the plus side. When our dad came to pick us up in the morning, her plus-sized dog jumped up on him. He petted her and said, "How you doing, fat dog?" Without thinking, I said, "Hey, don't talk to Aunt Nancy that way. I thought I was being funny, but as soon as the words left my mouth, I knew it was a mean thing to say. I apologized then, and every Sunday when I saw her at church for the next 5 years. 40 years later, my mom occasionally mentions Aunt Nancy's name on the phone, and that stupid, careless comment comes back to me. I can be hurtful, I think, and even mean-spirited. When Eric would talk or ask me about my day, I'd lead with the things I didn't get done, everything that went wrong, forgot someone's birthday, unforgivable. Motherhood had brought its own challenges. I'd been married before Eric and had 2 children I adored. I told myself they deserved nothing less than a perfect mom, then felt as if I'd failed them when I divorced their dad. After I married Eric, who also had 2 kids, Nathan came along. It felt like a second chance, but really, I'm still the 10-year-old girl who made a nasty mistake. I stopped myself before I could finish the thought and read Nathan's note again. If I wouldn't say something to him, then I shouldn't say it to myself either. I closed my eyes. Lord, Nathan is right. Help me see myself the way you see me. Show me how to love myself, even with all my flaws. I paused. With all my flaws. Maybe I should have skipped that part. The next morning, I went to the store and bought a cart full of groceries, but forgot the dog food, one of the main things I'd gone there for. I muttered about what a careless airhead I was. My day practically ruined before it started. Wait, I'd forgotten the dog food because I was preoccupied with getting all the ingredients for the dessert I wanted to make our small group at church that evening. A special recipe I'd found to accommodate someone's food allergies. I would pick up the dog food the next time I was out. There was no problem. Later, my mom called and mentioned having lunch with Aunt Nancy. I felt that familiar churn in my stomach, but I focused on the conversation and managed to silence the negative voices in my head. It wasn't easy. My negative self-talk had ruled me like a tyrant for so long. I hung up and opened the Bible app on my phone, looking for a verse that might help. I found 2 Corinthians 5:17, which says, "If anyone is in Christ, he is in a creation." I'm no longer that 10-year-old girl. I forgive her. She was just a kid who made a mistake. Who am I to expect perfection of myself? Perfection belongs only to you, God. Slowly, I felt a peace come over me, a perfect peace. When I picked up Nathan from school later that day, I said, "We need to run by the grocery store and get dog food. I can't believe I forgot." He shot me a look. What I meant to say is that I remembered everything for the special dessert for tonight, but we still need dog food. Nathan smiled. "That's better, Mom," he said. And that's the end of the story, but it's a new creation for this woman. And she is learning moment by moment to put that negative self-talk behind her. What's her name? It's Diane Stark. She's the author of this article called As God Sees Me. Well, I have a couple more stories I'd like to share with you before we finish off here today. So let me just locate them. This short story was written by Kevin Owens. Kevin lives in Fort Worth, Texas. I walked in the house exhausted after my overnight shift as a truck driver. All I wanted to do was crawl into bed. My wife, Wendy, works as an educator, and as always, she needed to leave for her school before I returned home. I went into our bedroom. The bed was made, and the covers on my side were folded down in an inviting way. I couldn't help but smile. Wendy was so thoughtful. I got a good day's sleep. Then it was time to head back to work. Unfortunately, I would have to leave before Wendy returned home. It was tough not seeing each other during the work week. I went to pack my lunchbox and saw that Wendy had made sandwiches, turkey and Miracle Whip, my favorite, and left them in the fridge for me. I grabbed a piece of paper and wrote a note, thanking her and telling her I missed her. I left it on her bed. When I folded it down the covers for her, just as she had done for me. Even though Wendy and I work opposite schedules during the week, we stay close by leaving little reminders that we're thinking of each other. And this story from Judith Sontag. She lives in Terre Haute, Indiana, and she writes, "Last February, I came across some heart-shaped sticky notes in fun colors on clearance. With Valentine's Day only 2 weeks away, I bought them, knowing I'd find a good use for them. That night, one of my roommates made us a delicious dinner. Before bed, I wrote, 'Thanks for dinner. You're a great cook,' on a note and stuck it to her bedroom door. I wrote a second note to my other roommate saying how much I liked the dessert she had made. The next morning, both of my friends were so thrilled, I decided to keep writing notes each day until Valentine's Day. I decorated their bedroom doors with a sticky note that described something I appreciated about them. 'You're such a great friend,' one note said. 'You make me laugh every day,' said another. My roommates look forward to seeing the colorful notes, and they made our apartment look cute, too. I saved the extra sticky notes so I could leave them for family members and co-workers this February. My sister, who's a nurse, is taking the idea to work as well. She plans to leave notes on the doors of her patients' hospital rooms to brighten their day." What a great idea. And this is something that can continue on way past Valentine's Day. So now, as you stretch and get on with your beautiful day ahead and your week ahead, I'd like to leave you with this message from Opal Lee. She's 97 years old. "I find that when I help somebody else, all my problems seem to disappear. I don't want you to think they go into thin air, but when I'm helping someone else, I get help for myself too."
Thank you for listening to Inspiration, and make it a great day. I'm Jessica Turvey, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour information access service.